My name is John Matlock. I'm the Director of Administration with Perimeter Institute. Thank you for coming out to Einstein Fest, and in particular to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas. I hope you enjoy the next presentation. Before I introduce our guest speaker, just a little bit of formatting and housekeeping to share with you. The presentation will last about 1 hour, after which we'll have 15 minutes of time for Q&A with the audience. And just for everybody's benefit, we'll be passing some microphones through the audience. So if you have a question at the end of the presentation, just please raise your hand and our volunteers will spot you, bring you a microphone, and we'll ask you to stand up and speak into the mic for the benefit of all when you have a question. After that, if time runs out and there's still lots of questions, Damien will have some time down here on the stage floor to speak one-on-one with you after everything is all over. I'll remind you to, at the end of the presentation, exit at the door on the top right, my top right of the theater, your left. And just a reminder that the tour goes through the entire building, ending on the bistro level, where if you're in need of some food or refreshment, that's available on the fourth floor. And we'll hope to see you back here at some of the other events, talks, and the exhibits again next weekend. If you're having lots of fun, be sure to tell your family and friends and come back with them. Okay. Damien Pope is Perimeter Institute's Director of Scientific Outreach. He comes to us from Australia. Damien tells me that he was into mathematics and physics and calculation at a very young age. He turned on to physics research as a career by reading popular books on subjects like quantum mechanics. He earned his PhD in physics in Melbourne, Australia. At the University of Queensland, and became a specialized scientist in a field known as quantum information theory. And concurrent with his research, he became somewhat of a public speaker in Australia on issues about modern physics, and even was seen on national television as somewhat of a science spokesperson. This all culminated in another degree in science communication. His unique combination as a researcher and teacher brought him to Perimeter Institute, where, not coincidentally, we specialize in scientific research and educational outreach. So the match is just tremendous for the Institute and for Damien. As our Director of Scientific Outreach, Damien is not only responsible for much of the content that you see in the atrium and the experiments in the Physica Fantastica tent outside, but he also spearheads the Institute's entire outreach mandate, including the in-class lectures across the country, teacher workshops across the country, and a full slate of science camps here at the Institute for teachers and students from around the world. On a personal note, I can tell you that Damien is a really terrific fellow to work with. He's a real gentleman, and he's a real physical fitness buff. He just finished the Toronto Half Marathon a week or so ago. He loves to hike and is interested in seeing parts of Canada and doing what he calls bushwalking in the Australian vernacular. And I don't quite understand this, but Damien is into a sport called unicycle field hockey in Australia, but I don't think he's found a team here yet in Canada. So, ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Damien Pope.
Thank you very much for the introduction. Well, most of it anyway. What I would like to do today is to talk a bit about that person up there. And I guess you'll recognize, hands up if you recognize who that person is. It's a bit of a giveaway. Great, that's fantastic. Hands up who's heard of the equation E equals mc squared? Okay, theory of relativity? Okay, so most people, so obviously we have a very expert audience today, so we can kind of have the advanced presentation today. Fantastic. Okay. So what I would like to talk about is that person who you all know is Albert Einstein. So I'd like to talk about some of his personality and just the burning curiosity and the continual questions he kept asking himself, because he was just always questioning and asking why. And those questions had a purpose and they led somewhere. And eventually in 1905, his miracle year at the age of 26, they all came to a head and he came up with some amazing, amazing discoveries in series about the fundamental things about the way the world works, about space, time, light, energy. They may all seem like, in some ways, abstract things, but once you understand those fundamental things that make up the entire physical world around us, you can put those to good use, you can harness them. And people have, and a lot of technologies that we take for granted today and we use, such as a digital camera, in part at least, go back to Einstein and you can relate them, you can see a direct link between them and some of the amazing discoveries Albert made 100 years ago. So in 2005, Einstein is very much very, very relevant. And so we'll look at this trait and really where it all starts with questions. But what I would like to begin with is by asking you a question. So some of you may have seen this, but I have a bag here. It's called a wind bag. It's kind of a, like a long, thin garbage bag. And the question I'd like to ask you is, how many breaths does it take to blow up? What's the smallest number of breaths you can blow up this with? So I might need a volunteer to help me out with this. And we have to think of a volunteer there, would you? And your... Adam? Great. Adam? Damien? Thank you very much. So if you could just come over here, if you could just blow this up for me, and maybe if you could just count how many breaths you've... Maybe if you could just take a couple of steps forward and just see how many breaths it takes. This talk could be a little bit longer than an hour. Okay. So shall we... Actually, shall we? Maybe that's enough. Maybe we can do a bit of science. So thank you very much, Adam. So that was was anyone counting? 12. So 12, and that's about a quarter, roughly. So that's about roughly 50 breaths. So about 50 breaths per blow up. So what if I could tell you? What if I told you I could blow it up in a single breath? So okay, let's We're using a little bit of a trick and a little bit of science. And so this really shows you, in a way, if you have some understanding of the way the world works, you can get things done a little bit more efficiently. So that was actually very good, and it takes most people 50 breaths or more. So I gave you a very, very hard task. So if you could just hold that end, maybe just up a bit higher at that shoulder height. And so what I'm going to attempt to do now is to blow this up in a single breath. Does anyone believe I can do it? Does anyone believe I can't do it? Does anyone not like putting their hand up? Okay. Okay. Just hold it still a little bit tighter. Yep. Okay. Okay. Oops. Let's give that one more go. It's Sunday morning. Okay. So science is unpredictable. So here we go. Could just, yep, that's fine. Okay, that's a bit better. If you could just let go. And there we have it. Okay. Thank you very much. But we really shouldn't leave Adam very unsuccessful. So would you like to have a go? So the trick is, and actually I can explain the trick while I'm explaining it to Adam, is you actually have to... So I'll do the holding. Actually, you have to put your mouth away, about 15 centimeters away from it. So, and then just blow in, not too hard. And what happens is Adam, while he's doing that, is fantastic. And you've got it. Well done. Thank you very much. And you actually get to take this home. Do you have large pockets? Okay. Yeah, but that is not all. Just before I explain it, we have actually a choice of prizes today. Einstein, some of you may have known, he actually worked approving inventions and discoveries. So he was what they call a patent clerk early on in his life. And one of the discoveries he actually patented and approved was the very, very important step in modern progress, the Toblerone chocolate bar. So this is option A for the prize. Option B, I thought, seeing it's edifying, we actually have original German versions of some of Einstein's papers from 1905. So, Adam? Okay, there you go. Thank you very much. Now, the reason that worked and Adam was able to do that is because when he actually had his mouth about 15 centimeters away, what he did was actually pushing all the air in front of the bag away, so he created kind of a low bit of low pressure in front of the bag, and then what happens is all the air from the sides, where there's higher pressure, rushes inwards towards the middle and then rushes into the bag. And so that's a nice little trick, and also it's very, very relevant, as it's thought to be used to help explain why planes fly, and it's called Bernoulli's principle, that really the lower the air pressure, the faster air moves. So that is a little trick, and really that starts with a question, and that came from scientist of discovery, Daniel Bernoulli, about a couple of hundred years ago in Holland. So really, that all starts with a question, and that really illustrates that a lot of things start with a question in science. So what I'll talk about some more, that's the summary I went through before. Really, Einstein's curiosity, the questions that it all begins with, the discoveries, and their impact on every single person in the audience today. So Einstein, he started very, very young, and this is actually a school photo of Einstein. And does anyone know which one? Can anyone pick Einstein there? Yes, you. Right. Which way? This way? This way? This way? Down? Really? How do you know? Okay, yes, that is actually true. And fantastic. If you actually look closely, he's actually the only one smiling there in the photo. So, so I think the German school system back then was fairly strict and authoritarian. But around about the age of 4 or 5, he was just absolutely captivated and fascinated by a compass that you see up there. And why, when he put it down on the ground, the needle, it just magically seemed to move around and align itself with the North Pole, the north direction. And why was it doing that? You couldn't actually see the magnetic force that was acting on it. And to him, it was just absolutely very, very interesting. And he kept on asking questions about that. And at school, so this presentation, I should say, it's aimed for people around about the age of 15 and up, so geared towards the sort of 15 to 18 age group. And so when he was round about perhaps the age of some people in this audience, around about six, actually I should say, who is in the age of 15 to 18? Okay. Right, okay, good, good. Who's older than 18? Okay, that's fine. So around the age of 16, so the age of some of the people in the audience here, he actually asked and was wondering about light. So what happens if you turn on a flashlight? The light just speeds away at the speed of light. And he wondered, what if he could actually run after a beam of light as it's going along from a flashlight or a laser beam? And if he could run fast enough, hypothetically, what would he actually see if he caught up with the beam of light? And that's actually very interesting, because although light seems to be instantaneous, you go to your room at home, you flick the light switch on, and the room, whole room seems to light up instantaneously at once. What is actually happening is the light takes a small, tiny split second, that's too small for us to notice, to actually go from the light bulb to the corners of the room. And we know that light has a finite speed. It takes some time to travel from one place to another, because the sun, it actually takes light 8 minutes to get from the sun to Earth. And light is also very, very strange. And one reason why it's strange is, imagine we have a car. So just forgetting about light for a moment. If we have a car that's going 100 kilometers an hour away from us, we're just standing up there. If we suddenly start running as a person down the bottom is towards it at 20 kilometers an hour, so we're going towards it, the car will seem to move away from us more slowly. So only about 80 kilometers an hour. So hopefully that should kind of be intuitive, because we're moving towards the car. So we're sort of making some distance on it, so it's moving away. But if we actually replace the car by light, then light actually moves at this incredibly fast speed, 300,000 kilometers per second. So it's roughly about a million times faster than a Boeing 747. And maybe it's about 10 million times faster, or even 25 million times faster than you might drive in your car along the freeway. So it's very, very fast. And it's so fast, actually, in fact, you could circle the entire globe about 7 times every second. So that's fast, but it still has some speed. But the point, the strange thing with light is, if you tried to actually run after a flashlight beam as it was moving away at the speed of light, no matter how fast you traveled, it would still go away and seem to go away at exactly the same speed, the speed of light. And so here, 20 kilometers per hour compared to 300,000 kilometers per hour is not much, but we could make this actually even 99% of the speed of light. So 299,999 kilometers per second. If you actually were traveling at that speed somehow, and actually tried to run and sort of catch up to light, or at least stop it from going away as fast as it could, then you couldn't make a dent in its speed. It would still go away from you at exactly the same distance per second. So that's a very, very, very strange thing. And even if you try and run away from light, it actually comes even if you try and go the opposite direction, run away, it doesn't increase its speed. It's exactly the same. So that's a very, very strange thing about light. And people at the time before Einstein really didn't understand this effect and didn't know about it. But Einstein, as we'll see a bit later, we'll get more into the explanation of that, he actually solved this mystery. So he was actually at the age of 16 getting into profound, profound mysteries and questions. And all his questioning came to head as an adult in 1905. And that was the so-called miracle year. So maybe some of you have seen the displays that we have out front. And they really illustrate the age of 26 years old. And the interesting thing was, he actually had a day job. As I said, he was working hard approving patents for Toblerone chocolate bars and other things. And he was married, he had a young kid, a wife. And so you might not think he had a lot of time in his hands. But in that year, he made and discovered and wrote 5 scientific papers that any scientist around here at Perimeter Institute and anyone around the world at the time would have just died to have written. There were just 5 amazing papers that came. It was an amazing outburst of creativity. And really, it didn't kind of just happen overnight. It's not like he suddenly woke up one morning. It's all of these really started back, and he himself said that, for example, one of his papers is theory of relativity or special relativity, really started when he was 16 years old with the initial question. So it all starts with questions and it all starts with ideas. And I was going to say is, some of you actually may be surprised that he was actually 26 years old, and that is a photo from him from 1905, and that's actually what he looked like. I think most people, it's fair to say, certainly a lot of studies, when people think of scientists, they think of people that are middle-aged, people that wear lab coats, people that have bad fashion sense. Does anyone think of scientists with a beard? Okay, so maybe if you actually, maybe we actually might do that now, we might just get a test. So I wonder if everyone could just close their eyes for a minute, and if I just say, just picture in your mind a scientist, so, and what that person looks like. Are they male or female? Do they have a beard or not? Are they wearing a 3-piece suit? So maybe if you could open your eyes, and what were some of the things that people had for? So was your how old was your scientist? Yeah. 60 with an old sweater. Okay. Did anyone? What kind of clothes were people scientists wearing? Did someone say bad? Okay, so bad clothes. Well, did anyone's scientists look kind of like that? Okay, a few people. Well, they've actually, as I said before, people have done lots of studies and various people have gone to schools and asked school children what scientists look like. And, well, not exactly like that, but that's roughly the stereotype they get, the mad scientist stereotype. And it's not really true. And the reason is you can actually look at a lot of advances in physics and mathematics. And strangely enough, very much physics and mathematics are for the young. And a lot of the discoveries in quantum physics and other areas of science were made by relatively young people, people in their early 20s, people in their mid-20s. And no one is really quite sure why this is the case, but very few discoveries, advances in science, have been made by people that look like that. Maybe young people have more creativity, maybe they have more time on their hands, who knows. But one extreme case of that is actually the person you see up there. That's actually a 16-year-old schoolgirl, and it's a very amazing story. Her name's Sarah Flannery, and a couple of years ago in Ireland, as I said before, just at the age of 16 years, she made what appeared to be a major, major breakthrough in the study of secret codes or cryptography that got a lot of professional people that spent their life actually working on this very, very excited about. And that really, again, started from her curiosity and interest and passion and questions, just like with Albert Einstein at the age of 26. So what actually did Albert discover? What were some of the things he looked at? And we'll go through now. One question that he was asking himself is, what makes up light? So light is something we're incredibly familiar with. We have the sun that we can see out today, and there's solar light. And we also have the light that we use, basically electricity, we all to light our lives during the night. And another more recent type of light is actually laser light. So light is just everywhere around us. And laser light, it's used in medical applications. It's used in the supermarket, laser barcode scanners. And again, that actually in part gets back to a discovery Einstein made a little bit later on in his life. So light is all around us. And what's it actually made of? If you could look at light really, really closely, what it would be made of? We see all these little men running around and waving around or something like that. Would it be made up of interconnected strings, or who knows? At the time, around about 1905, most scientists thought that light was made up of waves. So if you get a stone and you get a still pond and drop that stone into the pond, what happens is it creates ripples, and there's sort of wave undulating ripples, and there are crests and troughs that go up and down. And it's a rough analogy, but at the time most scientists thought that light was kind of made up of wavy waves, a little bit like ripples in a pond, but a little bit more, well, basically light, waves of light, so to speak. And Einstein actually disagreed with that, and he came up with a different theory. And that theory said light was mainly made up of particles. So if you actually look at light really closely, there are these tiny particles of photons, a little packets and clumps of pure energy. And the way he came about that was a mystery, a very important mystery that it was around at the time, had been around for about 70 years, that no other scientist had been able to solve. And it's called, well, don't want to get too technical, but if you want to impress your friends at school tomorrow, it's called the photoelectric effect. And if we have kind of a lump of metal, so I have a lump of brass or a lump of zinc or a lump of iron, just like a metal sheet there, and if we get a flashlight, and a really, really a red flashlight, so we've got some red cellophane over it, turn it on and red light comes out. What scientists at the time knew, you could get as powerful and as bright a red flashlight as you wanted to, and you actually nothing would happen to the metal. We do know now that if you actually look inside the metal, metal is made of atoms, as everything else is. And there are tiny, tiny particles with sort of negative electric charge there, and they're called electrons. And so there are all these electrons in the metal, and some of them actually aren't just kind of weakly attached to the metal. So they're actually not sort of tied in and bound in and sort of tied up too tightly. So if you gave them sort of enough of a kick or you gave them enough energy, potentially they could basically get knocked off or flee off or go off the metal. And the interesting thing is you could get an incredibly powerful beam of red light and then nothing would happen. You could get no electrons being knocked off whatsoever. But what scientists knew at the time, if you got, for example, light at a higher frequency, blue light or even ultraviolet light, then you could actually just get a very, very faint torch, just very, very, one that could be not very powerful at all, but you could shine it on, and you could actually get lots and lots of these electrons, which are just very, very loosely sitting there on the surface of the metal and around the metal. You could actually get a lot of them just being knocked off. They're actually being bumped by the light and knocked off. And the strange thing was that this beam of light, could have a lot more energy, could have 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more energy, the red beam of light, than the blue beam here, but yet it didn't actually knock off any electrons whatsoever. So the question was, why, if the red beam has so much energy, does it actually not knock off a single electron? And Einstein actually came up with the answer, and that was in terms of particles of light. So he said, yes, it's actually particles. And so if we look at all the light, laser light, sunlight, the light actually coming from here, he said you can think of it as being made of tiny packets of particles or clumps of pure energy called photons. And it turns out that the photons, or the clumps of energy making up the red light, even though there's lots and lots, billions and billions of these photons or packets of energy, each single one of them is only very, very weak. They only have a small amount of energy. And so every one of them is very feeble, and it doesn't actually have enough energy to knock out electron, because the photons from the red beam of the torch are hitting the light in a very random, disorganized way. So it's like a great big crowd of people. They're all sort of fighting and moving in different directions independently. So at any one time, it's pretty much likely that only one of those photons will hit an electron. Each one of them is very weak, so it doesn't actually knock off the electrons. But the blue light, even though there's less energy, less photons, every one of them is more energetic. They have more energy, so they're much more likely to knock off the are electrons, and in fact they do. So a kind of analogy, imagine if you had just a brick wall. So I had a thousand bricks here, and I make a wall out of the bricks, and I forget, I don't put the mortar in, so we just have this bricks resting there, and I have a million ping pong balls. So I've got a lot of time in my hands, and I basically start throwing these ping pong balls in a random fashion at the wall of bricks. What actually happens, even though I've got lots and lots of ping pong balls, and in total the energy from all of those ping pong balls is very, very great, no single ping pong ball, because they're fairly small, I'm not throwing them too hard, has enough energy to knock out any of the bricks. Just as none of the photons in the red beam have enough energy to knock out any of the electrons in the metal, the lump of metal. And so what that means is that we'll just get nothing happening. All the brick wall will be intact, and similarly all the photons, the electrons, will be intact in the lump or piece of metal before. But the kind of analogy for the blue light would be something like a basketball. So maybe I had 10 or 20 or 30 basketballs, I have a lot less basketballs, a lot less energy, a lot less photons overall, but each one of them has more oomph. So if you've got to throw a basketball fairly hard at a wall of bricks, just bricks laying there, you'll knock some of them out. The wall will soon fall apart. You know, basketballs are large enough to do that. And so Einstein said, look, we don't have basketballs in this blue light, but we have these photons, and they're, each one of them packs a greater punch. They have a lot more energy, and so they can actually knock out electrons. It's got to be a single basketball or a single photon that can do that. So that was Einstein's solution. And so you might be kind of wondering how relevant that is to today, but the point is, as I was saying before, light is everywhere. If there was no light, we couldn't see. So once you understand this fundamental thing about the world around you, as I said, that allows you to use light and to harness it in many, many ways. And we think of, there are lots and lots of technologies that we have. And the effect is called the photoelectric effect because it has light, photons or photo for light, and then it has electricity. And so there are a lot of devices that we use today that actually convert light to electricity. And one example is a digital camera. And so we have light that basically comes, I guess, from an object. If we're taking a photo of a tree, it bounces from the sun into the tree and then into the camera. And then actually inside the camera we have, actually there are sort of semiconductors, so somewhere halfway between metals and insulators. We have these, basically this materials inside there, and they actually absorb the light, and actually that affects some of the electrons inside the camera and starts them moving, gives them energy. And what that does is actually stores then the light as, or the image actually in the form of electricity or electronics. So we actually have getting converting from light into electricity there. So we have this electronic image or photo stored inside the camera. You can basically pick up or use or look at it any time. And that actually directly uses Einstein's photoelectric effect in the sense that you can understand the process, how you're getting from light being converted into electricity by the same way. You can understand the same principles of this process here. Another example is, hopefully we'll be seeing a lot more of this in the future, is solar power. We shine light on a solar panel that actually, the photons in there actually can knock off electrons, so you have free electrons. And what free electrons do is they make a current, an electric current. And that's exactly the same kind of electrical current we use when we're switching on and using our TV, exactly the same one we're using when we're watching a computer or making our toast in the morning. And so these actually use the photoelectric effect to create light, to create electricity from light. And so that's another example, which, sure, there are lots of engineers involved, and Einstein didn't directly create solar cells, solar power, or digital cameras, but he was a crucial part of the puzzle, because if the engineers didn't have the understanding of actually how light worked, then they couldn't have, it would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, for them to actually create some of these gadgets that we have here. So it all starts with the questions that Einstein had when he was 16 years old, and the questions, and then the ideas, and then the actual implementation of technology. So you can actually see this kind of a chain here, the questions, ideas, answers, and discoveries, and technologies. And so we have a lot of people doing research, a lot of professional scientists and physicists, asking a lot of questions themselves at Perimeter Institute. Where we kind of might fit into this grand scheme of things is, in a sense, very much the ideas and the questions. So the people here aren't really into making gadgets or the next digital camera or the next solar cell, but in essence, they're looking at these ideas and So actually, what is matter or everything in the world made of at the most fundamental level? How did the universe begin? What are the fundamental ideas that underlie every single atom and electron and other subatomic particle? And hopefully, well, definitely some of the scientists here are starting to come up with some answers, along with all the other scientists around the world. And quite possibly, they will feed into technologies 100 years from now. Now, it's not always a direct process, and many, many ideas scientists come up with. In fact, most of them don't lead on directly to technologies. But unless you have this sort of advancing understanding of the world, then it's very hard to see how new technologies and advances and applications will occur. So, something else that Einstein thought about was his theory of relativity, or I should say his theory of special relativity in 1905. And at the time, physicists had ideas about space and time that go back to Isaac Newton from the 17th century. And these had been in place for around about 250 years, so for a long, long time. And according to Newton, space and time were absolute. So space was this invisible stuff that was just always there. So even if you had nothing, you always had absolute space. There was just a space there. So in a way, as if when sort of God made the world, he or she put all this sort of space in there, there's sort of this essence, the sort of framework for everything. And that he said that clocks, no matter where they are or how they're moving, time ticks at exactly the same rate, 1 second per second, everywhere in the universe. It's a very absolute universal idea. But Einstein said something different. He said that time and space actually change and are modified and are relative to your perspective and how you're moving. And when you actually move very fast, then time and space actually get warped. Now, we don't actually see these effects in real life because they're only really apparent when you're moving at a fairly high, at a reasonable speed relative to the speed of light. Now, as I said before, light moves really fast. Now, when I say fast, I mean really fast. So as I said before, fast enough to circle the globe 7 times in a single second. And so most of the time, at least, all the people I know don't move or drive their cars or ride their bikes anywhere near that fast. So according to Einstein, we just move at these tiny, tiny speeds, and that's why we don't see any of these strange effects. But we actually do have some things on Earth that move that fast. And there are things called huge experiments called atom smashers or particle accelerators. And they get tiny subatomic particles like electrons and protons. And there may be 6 of them, 10 of them or so around the world. What they do is they're huge underground tunnels. And they actually get big magnets and electric fields and actually accelerate. They can accelerate these tiny particles, subatomic particles, up to speeds 99.999% of the speed of light. And when they actually do these and look at how they move, they actually see these warping of time and space effects that Einstein was talked about. So what I'm going to do now, some of them are very hard to explain, but I'm actually going to show you some movies. So we're actually going to take a roller coaster ride at the 99% of the speed of light, because it's kind of hard to actually get everyone moving at that speed. But for example, if I was giving a course and this was on flight instruction, I was teaching you how to fly, it might be kind of hard to wheel in a Boeing 747 into this room and get everyone to fly. But the next best thing I could do is I could have a flight simulator. So I could actually show you what it would be like if you were behind the wheel of a Boeing 747. So what I actually have is what you might call an Einstein simulator. And this actually shows you what you would see if you were traveling at 99% of the speed of light, exactly according to Einstein. So we're actually going to take a roller coaster ride. So this is actually some computer animations that some scientists have done. And it's called Through Einstein's Eyes. And so what you will see, it almost seems like a dream or some kind of weird, surreal experience. So let's see, we'll go to the roller coaster. And what you actually will see is some of the straight lines, the railings on the roller coaster, will actually appear to be bent. So straight objects appear to be bent and warped because they're moving so fast. Colors of things will change. And that's similar because the colors are related to the frequency of light. And has anyone had that experience where you have a siren going past, an ambulance siren or a police siren, and it changes frequency? It's higher pitches that's coming towards you, then it goes past and it goes lower in pitch. Has anyone kind of experienced that? Well, That's called, well, technically it's called a sort of Doppler shift, but it's a change in the frequency of the sound as it goes past you because it's moving towards us. And so what we'll get is a change in the frequency or the light or the color of light. So you should see some changes in some color and also a number of other effects we'll see. So we'll take you on the ride now. So look out for the yellow and the red railing start to curve then. That's the colour change that I was talking about. In a sense, one way to think of it is that time and space are actually being mixed up. Instead of just seeing space at any one time, we've mixed with space. We had a plan to build one of these for Einstein Fest, but the budget just kind of flew out of it. So that's what a roller coaster ride will be like at 99% of the speed of light. I'd like to take you on another journey now, and this is actually driving in a car or maybe riding a bike at 99% of the speed of light. And one interesting thing there is you actually end up seeing things behind you when you're in front. So if you actually want it riding your bike home from school and you actually want to kind of turn around and see what's behind you without turning your head, all you need to do is travel at 99% of the speed of light, and then basically everything, almost everything that's behind you appears to be right in front of you. So it's this really weird effect that what happens is your whole field of vision, instead of being in front of you and to the side, actually gets sort of squished or compressed around to a very, very narrow angle in front of you. And it's called the headlight effect. And I should say one thing, what you'll notice, I guess the yellow railings kind of seem like they were bent around like bananas. And that one way you can think of why that was happening is because space and time were being mixed up. So we're seeing different parts of the railing as they were at different times. And different times they were at, because they were moving towards it, various parts of it were different lengths or distances away from us. So we saw the middle as it was at a later time when it was closer to us, so it seemed closer to us, and the railing, the edges were actually bent away from us. You saw down the bottom. Maybe if I can just show that. Yeah, so that's one example there. We're seeing this as it is at a later time, and the edges here, how they were at an earlier time, because time and space are being mixed up. At an earlier time, because we're moving towards us, they were a little bit further away from us, and so we actually get the banana shape there. So that's at an earlier time, a later time, and if you actually kind of sort of join up all the points into a line, that's what you actually see. So we'll go on the trip now. Desert Road, okay. So what you actually will see is you should see again the colors changing, the Doppler shift as the frequencies change as we're moving towards it. But the strange thing is we're always moving towards the building here on the right, but at the very first bit of it, maybe the first 15 seconds, if you actually look closely, it looks like we're moving away from it, but we're actually moving towards it, which is a very, very strange effect. We'll see the color in the desert change, and everything else will seem black around us, except for the small sort of narrow band in the middle, which gets smaller and smaller and smaller. And the reason that's happening is we're actually going so fast, we're not catching up to the light, we're actually meeting rays of light that came from all different angles, and photons that we would normally miss that would just go in front of us, we're actually sort of catching up with them from all different angles. And because of that, we actually see things that are behind us, almost around to everything but except what's directly behind us. And the other thing we should see is the building and the signs actually kind of spin and seem to rotate around, because we can actually kind of, in a sense, even though they might be behind us, we can actually see the signs because we're seeing all the light from around. So it might seem a bit weird, but that's the portion of the speed of light there. So 25% speed of light getting faster. That just shows you where we are in relation to the building. You can see the color change here. Sky is being squished in up there. So if anyone has ever seen any of those effects while you're driving, you need to slow down. So that's actually another interesting thing is that we thought, I mean, we're nowhere near traveling with even with the fastest spaceships we have with the space shuttle at the speed of light or anywhere near the speed of light. But scientists are working on near light speed travel. It might be hundreds or thousands of years away. But if we did, according to Einstein, one thing that might be, we would actually see this effect, this sort of strange effect, that all the stars in front of us, all our field of view, would actually get squished and compressed into the smaller and smaller region. And sometimes that's known as the headlight effect. And it would kind of make it hard to navigate because everything, basically, it's almost like everything gets sort of layered on top of each other and sort of squished into one. And all of this stuff is actually around us, but it just appears to be in this narrow band. This is what you would actually see. So it would make it kind of hard to, if you were maybe driving home and the exit road you had to go out on the left and to the right was actually right at the same location you saw it in front of your eyes as the sort of the main highway going along. So it would probably make navigation somewhat problematic. We might just take two more journeys. And one is actually going through a cube at, I think it's 87% of the speed of light. And the strange thing is the cube actually seems to turn inside out. And we actually see, so it's like a hollow, maybe I'll just show what it looks like. Another thing that directly follows from here is we have this hollow cube and we're going to fly through the middle. Another thing that directly follows from Einstein's theories is that we'll actually see, because again, space and time are being mixed up, space and time are being distorted, they're relative to our perspective, what will happen is the cube will actually seem to kind of go inside out and will actually look to us as if we're passing through the back part of it before we get through the front. And we can actually be through, we actually sort of pass, imagine being in a little plane or a helicopter, actually sort of flying through the middle of this cube. We'll actually be well and truly past the cube, but it will seem like it's in front of us. And that's because we're just going so fast, there are beams of light or photons of light that have actually come from the cube and have actually bounced off and are going away from the cube, but we're going so fast, we actually catch up to them and actually see the cube that's behind us. And you can actually see in the bottom corner where we are through the cube. And you'll see we're well and truly through the cube, but it seems to be in front of us. So this is a very, very strange thing. So I don't recommend people do this at home. So 99% of the speed of light. Again, we'll see the sides of the cube being bent and distorted like the railings of the roller coaster. We're through the cube now, we're outside. That's the back wall that seems to come into the front. I might just turn off there. So these hopefully have given you some of the ideas of Einstein's theory of special relativity, where you get space and time being mixed up and being distorted. And I didn't quite mention them, but you can see the effects of time actually slowing down the faster you move, at least from perspective of someone watching you. And that's called sort of time dilation or time slowdown. Another effect you can actually see was in some of the movies there was actually objects shrinking. Objects shrinking is the faster they go relative to someone. So These all might make seem like very, very esoteric things. At the time, in 1905, when Einstein made the discoveries, no one was thinking that they could have been of any use or have any technological applications whatsoever. After all, they're just, you know, far, far beyond our domain of what we could see, what we could use. But the interesting thing is that some of those effects you show in the video, and in particular time dilation, are actually used today in something called the GPS, or the Global Positioning System. So some of you, has anyone, hands up who's heard of the GPS? Yeah. So what it is a network of 24 satellites orbiting about 20,000 kilometers above the Earth. And they actually used continually sending out just electronic blips, signals. And if you have a GPS receiver, and a lot of taxis have them, planes use a GPS to navigate, hikers do, and even emergency services vehicles. It's a navigation system for finding exactly where you are at any point on the planet, down to within, I think it's something like a couple of meters. So it's incredibly accurate. Even farmers use the GPS to help some farmers plant their crops in straight lines, just get the tractor to navigate via GPS. And the fascinating thing is, where the satellites are actually in outer space, time is actually passing a little bit faster. So it's kind of a little bit complicated, the reason why. It's a number of effects involved. But one of the effects is actually the fact that comes from Einstein's theory of special relativity, that the faster you go, time actually slows down. So it's a bit weird. That you actually need to factor in. And also another factor from his general theory of relativity, that gravity actually also slows down time. And so where the satellites are, 20,000 kilometers up in deep space, time actually goes a little bit more quickly. And that's because out in deep space, the gravity is actually slightly less. And so basically it affects the timing and the rate at which these satellites tick as they're sending out signals, say, each second. And that's actually just a little bit quicker. So they're just ticking a little bit more quickly there. And we're getting these satellites if you have a GPS receiver on Earth. And if you get a signal from one satellite, then you know when it was sent, and you know when you received it by looking at your watch, because they have a time signal saying, well, this signal was sent at 12 o'clock and 0 seconds. You might get it at 12 o'clock and 1 second, so you know, well, I'm 1 second away from that satellite. And you can find out where you are away from 3 or 4 satellites. And when you do that, you can kind of do some kind of triangulation process. Just as with the street directory, what you can do is find out how many grid spaces you are along from the left corner, and then how many grid spaces you are down from the top. And you can find out where you are via some kind of triangulation process. So you can do the same sort of a thing with the satellites. And once you know where you are from 3 satellites, you know, bam, exactly where you are on the planet, down to within a couple of meters. And the interesting thing is, there's just a small fraction of a second difference caused by Einstein's theory of relativity. But light, in a fraction of a second, can travel very, very fast. Because in a second, it can travel 300,000 kilometers. So in a millionth of a second, it can travel 300 meters. So that's just enough to put the system off. If you actually forgot about Einstein's theory of relativity, you got in a taxi that was using satellite navigation, relying on it to get you home, you'd end up at your friend's house 10 kilometers down the road. So it would not be very useful at all. So it absolutely, the ideas that go back to Einstein in 1905 are very, very relevant and very, very useful. Oops. So another thing, the other main discovery in question Einstein was asking himself is, so I guess we have the chain here. So we have the chain going from questions, how does light move, to ideas. Well, oh, how fast does light move? To ideas, the ideas with sort of relativity and space and time distorting, seeing things behind you, time slowing down the faster you go. And we end up with the answers and discoveries, the theory of relativity, special relativity, and the technologies. And so again, it's not always as neat a pattern like that. And to get to the technologies, you need armies of engineers working on these, fine-tuning these, but definitely understanding drives innovation. And we live today in the start of the 21st century in an incredibly technological world. Everyone has a whole bunch of gadgets that they use every day. And at the back of those is a lot of physics and understanding and knowledge about the basic things around us. Because all these gadgets that we use, they're made of atoms, they're made of things, they're made of physical stuff. and the understanding that Einstein and other scientists did to advance our knowledge of this physical stuff feeds in to all these modern gadgets such as BlackBerries, computers, cell phones, for example. So the last question I'd like to look at that Einstein was asking himself in 1905 was, what makes up all objects? And so even Toblerone bars are made of objects called atoms. Does anyone know, actually maybe, does anyone in the 15 to 18 year old age group know what atoms are made of? Anyone tell me anything that's inside an atom? Yes, you're in the red shirt and proton, neutrons, electrons, fantastic. So, paper or the Toblerone? Sorry? Okay. So, thank you, great. So before I gave this talk, I thought I was really in touch with what kids were into, and I thought, yeah, it's a scientific, they want to be edified and they want more knowledge, but maybe I misjudged them. Okay. But I did have one, actually, we had one child yesterday, one kid had a talk yesterday for 10 to 14 year olds, and he took the paper. I just hope he speaks German. So atoms, everything around you, the chairs that you're sitting on, the cars you drive, the bicycles you drive, all your clothes are made of these tiny, tiny particles called atoms. And what atoms are, they're about a million times smaller than a grain of sand. So they're incredibly tiny. And it's very, very hard just to imagine how small atoms are. So what I've done is, to actually help people, is I've brought along a couple of grains of sand in my pocket, and we might just hand them around, just if I can get them now, some people. So, yep, here they are. So if I could just... But I do actually need these back, because we have 3 more weeks of Einstein Fest. So we have a talk. So, so if you could just get that... If you could just take off that there, that little grain. Okay, you got that? Great. Okay, so if you could just hand that around, and the last person up the back there in that far corner, could you just bring that back at the end? That would be fantastic. So atoms, and while you're handling that, can you imagine, it's right? Okay, imagine something a million times smaller than that. That's the scale of atoms. They're so small you can't see them, and because of that, a lot of scientists back then didn't even believe 100 years ago that atoms existed. A lot did, but the reason for the divide was there's no compelling reason. You couldn't directly see them. The scientists believed in them. You couldn't just point to them and say, look, there's an atom running around in the field there. And so it was a very sort of indirect evidence. But Einstein came up with a crucial experiment that he said, look, if you do this experiment, this will provide just compelling, dead-set proof that atoms are real and atoms exist. And 3 years after that, a French scientist, Jean Perrin, did the experiment in 1908 and saw exactly what Einstein said he would, and then won the 1926 Nobel Prize for doing that experiment. So Einstein provided really the idea for the experiment that nailed the existence of atoms. And as it says up there, atoms, you can think of them as like tiny building blocks or Lego blocks or Lego blocks that make up all physical objects around us. So everything's made of atoms. And his questions, what makes up all objects, they provided a key element in proving that atoms are real. And where it came from was an experiment, the technical term is called Brownian motion. So what was known at the time was that you could get, for example, there's an experiment up there, you could get some milk and just dilute some milk. And inside milk, there are small, small fat particles. They're a lot bigger than atoms. But if you looked at the milk diluted in water under a microscope, what you can actually see is this, the fat particles in the milk. They actually kind of jiggle or move around in a random fashion. Sometimes they go this way, sometimes they go that way, sometimes up and sometimes down. So they're just sort of randomly moving in this pattern, this is sort of aimlessly. And scientists had known about this for about 60, 70 years, but they didn't know why this happened. Why did they move like this? There didn't seem to be any reason why they did. And no one really could explain, except for Einstein, when he came along in 1905. And this was another huge, huge discovery that he made. And what he said was that the water is made up of invisible water molecules. Now, water molecules, again, they're about a million times smaller, or maybe about 100,000 times smaller than a grain of sand, or probably a million times smaller.
And you can't actually see them. But there are all of them, these millions and millions of invisible water molecules, and what they're doing is they're just randomly bombarding, and they're hitting the fat particles from either side. So some are coming in from the left and hitting a fat particle this way, some are coming from above and hitting it from above. And so that's, so they get knocked one way, knocked another way, and another way. And so they don't move very fast any individual go, because these tiny, tiny particles are knocking them maybe thousands of times smaller than them, but the overall effect, there are lots and lots of water molecules, is for the big fat particles to move around in this sort of random pattern. And that was Einstein's explanation for it. And he said, look, the reason is that these atoms, and you can't really explain this motion that you can see, these fat particles jiggling around, unless you assume that atoms exist. And he actually was able to make very definite, concrete predictions based on his model. So he had the model involving atoms and molecules, and he said, look, if this is real, you'll see the particles move this far in this amount of time. And then the scientist, John Perrin, did the experiment 3 years later and exactly confirmed Einstein's prediction. And so the Brownian motion, if you want kind of an analogy for that, what it's a little bit like, imagine if I have a basketball in a room. I guess I like basketballs and ping pong balls. So if we have another bunch of those, and we have a basketball in the middle of a room, and I have a million ping pong balls, and we've got people, for some reason, just throwing ping pong balls randomly at the atom, at the basketball from either side. And sometimes some ping pong balls will hit the atom, it'll move one way, and then some other ping pong balls will hit, will move another way. So we're randomly moving around this way and that way. And it doesn't, won't seem to be any organized pattern to the way it's moving. And what that, roughly speaking, that basketball will be doing, that will be moving in this sort of Brownian motion pattern. And the term Brownian motion, I should say, it goes back to a scientist called Mr. Brown in 1827, was one of the first scientists to see that. So the name doesn't really matter what it's called, but it's basically sort of random motion, this random jiggling motion. And that was a key reason, that was what sparked Einstein to come up with this idea of atoms and Brownian motion. And once you understand atoms and know that they're real and understand more about them, you think of everything that's made from atoms. Absolutely, you know, everything in the, all the physical objects that we're, most of them that we're familiar with. So once you understand atoms, then that gives you so much more utility and power in ways you can potentially harness them for technologies. And one strange thing is that actually, you may not think of physicists as people that make lots of money, and Einstein wasn't really that rich, but it's actually Brownian motion, it's actually used in predicting the stock market by thousands of people a day to make or lose millions of dollars per day. And the reason is that Einstein came up with a mathematical model that involves some math for understanding exactly how these particles jiggle around. Now, I don't really understand much about stocks, but you know, if I look at stock prices each day, they just seem to go up and down and fluctuate randomly for no apparent reason. So it's very, very strange, but just turns out the math that Einstein exactly used for finding out how these particles, these fat particles and other time particles move and randomly jiggle around, was exactly the right type of math for trying to understand stock patterns and why stocks, if you've seen those stock charts where it's sort of basically going up and down, to actually understand that. So they're used by a lot of people, financial traders all around the world today. So again, we can see this pattern of starting with the question, the curiosity, what actually makes up atoms? And the answer is, what actually makes up everything in the physical world? The answer is atoms, and it's led on to an application. And so I would like to sort of conclude, and one thing is quote there from Albert. So the important thing is not to stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. And Einstein himself said that often the children are naturally curious, and children ask a lot of questions. Why is the sky the color it is? Why is it blue? What is snow made of, for example? But he said that often as adults, people generally stop asking sort of these sort of questions, you get on with life and so forth. But he said that one of the reasons he thought that he was able to make the discoveries was he did, was he actually kept on asking these questions that a child asks up into his mid-20s, his 30s, and even right up until the last day of his life. On the day that he died, he was actually working on physics, and people, I think, on his deathbed found some papers and equations he was actually working on. So all throughout his life, he did have this childlike quality. And he was able to actually think and ask simple questions Because one thing that he really did was he often thought in a lot of simple pictures. And one example of those is, what would you actually see if you're able to catch up with a beam of light? Another one that led to his theory of general relativity, sort of piece de resistance in 1915, which was his theory of gravity, was he had this thought. He called it the happiest thought of his life. And that was, he was sitting in his patent office in his chair in Switzerland in 1915 in Bern, and he wondered, 1907, and he wondered what would actually happen, what would he feel or experience if he actually suddenly fell off his chair and was actually sort of for a split second kind of in free fall motion, like an astronaut that's sort of going for a spacewalk in a space shuttle. And for that split second, he realized that he'd seemed to be weightless. And that was a key reason that related sort of acceleration and gravity together. And that was really started him on the road, although admittedly it was a very long and torturous road, to his amazing theory of general relativity, this theory of gravity. So just to conclude, Einstein was an incredibly curious person as a kid. He was like a detective, always asking questions. And he kept on asking questions and kept on being curious. And he eventually, 1905, everything came to a head, and he came up with a number of answers. All the hard work paid off. And he came up with an amazing idea about what makes up light, photons, tiny bundles of energy, packets of energy. And that was one of his amazing discoveries, and that feeds into digital cameras. The other one was, what is the essence of space and time? And where does light fit into the picture? And that was his theory of relativity, which again has very weird effects about time slowing down, objects shrinking, and that is fed into the global positioning system. And finally, what makes up every physical object? What makes up all matter or all objects? And that is atoms. He came up with, helped scientists to find out with a crucial clinching piece of evidence for showing that atoms are actually real. And that has led on to many, many applications, including in the stock market today. So really, science and Albert and even all the science at Perimeter Institute today and around the world, it all starts with questions and with curiosity and ideas. So that's the end of my talk. Thank you.
Thank you, Damien. So we're going to bring up some house lights now. We have about 10 minutes left for some questions, and we'll ask anybody with a question to raise their hand really high, and our two volunteers will pass microphones through the house. So if you want to stand up. Thank you.
How did Einstein figure out that no matter how fast he ran, the speed of light would not change?
The way he did that was through a variety of means, but mainly at the time there was a really good theory of electricity and of magnets, and that came from a number of a British scientist called Maxwell, James Clerk Maxwell, and he had this great, fantastic theory, understood of how electricity and magnets worked. And what Einstein did was he looked very, very closely at that theory, which had been around for maybe about 30 or 40 years. And he looked, and he realized that if you looked at that theory, that no matter how fast you traveled, what speed you were traveling at, light always seemed to move away from you at the speed of light. So it was very interesting. And Einstein, he was a pretty gutsy scientist, because there was this Isaac Newton's theory, which had been around for 250 years. Einstein, Newton was a god. Scientists revered him. And that was more established than this new theory, which had only been around for about maybe 30 years, and that was Maxwell's theory. And that, according to Newton's theory, the speed of light would change, no matter how fast you ran or moved, when you moved towards it or away from it. So you had this 250-odd theory, could go with it, or this new upstart theory, 30, 40 years old, and he had the courage enough to go with a new theory and to trust it and to see what implications followed on from that.
Einstein's wife was a brilliant mathematician. Mm-hmm. Indeed, some people say that his early papers would not have been possible without the clarity of thought mm-hmm. that she provided to them. Indeed, she might even have co-authored them. Mm-hmm. Now, only some accept that. What do you believe?
Do I believe it? Well, first of all, I'll say it's impossible to exactly know, to go back 100 years in time and to know what was going on then. But certainly, they met while they were both, I believe, studying physics at university. She knew something about physics, and we do know that Einstein talked to her about some of the physics involved. But certainly, I'll say, I haven't seen any good, solid historical evidence that suggests that she was that she wrote all of the papers or even most of the papers herself. So I believe that she played some role. Everyone believes that. But in terms of, was she the main driver behind them? Did she provide most of it? I haven't seen any good evidence to sort of support that. And also after that, certainly after, because they sort of unfortunately ended up sort of parting ways, Einstein definitely made a lot of other major discoveries after that. Having said that, in general and in science and physics and in history, there are lots and lots of examples where the role of women has definitely been underplayed. And one example people talk about a lot is, I think it's Rosalind Franklin, who her role in discovering the DNA. So definitely, I think physics has a lot of work in general to support women and to actually get more women involved. But in this particular case, I haven't seen any good evidence of supporting that she was the main driver behind those papers.
Thank you for your very interesting lecture. It appears to me that this limitation of the speed of light seems to apply to things that are made of substance or matter, physical.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I don't know if you're familiar with Bill Tiller, who is he's a metallurgist from San Francisco, and he's doing a lot of work in the transpersonal realm. And he and a lot of other people have done work with the power of intention and showing that, you know, things can happen instantaneously across space and time, and that there are perhaps energies that can actually transcend light. Mm-hmm. Do you know if any of that kind of work is being entertained here or in the physics, in physics in this institute at all? Or
So I'm not actually completely familiar with that work. I'd be happy to find out more about it later on. But just from the brief sound of it, I don't think there's anything going along that lines here. Having said that even though we revere Einstein, we talk about his theory of relativity, certainly nothing is set in stone in science. And the history of science is a new theory overturning and replacing an old theory and showing that the old theory was wrong or limited. So almost certainly Einstein's theory is not the final word in science. So we have a lot of things more to find out about the universe. And maybe there is some way of breaking the speed of light. I mean, we just don't know. Certainly, to our best of our understanding, you're right. When it does come to objects that have mass, they can't go. The speed of light is the cosmic speed limit for them. But there's a whole lot out there in the universe we don't know about. So who knows? Do we have any questions from people in the 15 to 18-year-old? Yes.
What causes did Einstein die from?
What causes did he die from?
Yes.
Does anyone know? I don't actually know. I thought maybe it was an aneurysm. Does anyone know? You mean like what illness or sickness he died? For some reason an aneurysm was like a heart attack or something like that. Seems to bear to mind, but I don't know. He was about 74, 75 years old, so he was fairly old. And again, it's a little bit earlier in time, so perhaps they didn't have some of the medical technologies we had, but it wasn't any particular disease or cancer or anything. I think it was a heart attack or something related to that general decline in health. But yeah, Google will do Google search.
I won't be able to stand up, but I have a question. In 1905, he did the theory of relativity, and then in 1915, he completed his general theory. Mm-hmm. Was there a huge difference between the two papers? Was there any distinctive difference between the two?
Absolutely. Special relativity dealt with a really special case or a particular case. It was just this tiny bit. General relativity just completely generalized it and expanded it to include gravity. So special relativity didn't take into account any acceleration, so objects that were speeding up or slowing down, just if you're moving at a constant speed. So driving along a freeway at 60 kilometers per hour. But general relativity dealt with acceleration and dealt with gravity. And Einstein himself said that compared to the theory of special relativity, general relativity, well, he said compared to general relativity, special relativity was like child's play. He spent 8 long, hard, slogging, grueling years working on general relativity. He had to find out a whole lot of mathematics, and it was very, very tough. And general relativity is one of, you know, the greatest theories of all time. So it was, yeah, a lot harder, a lot more generalized.
We have time for one more question right over here.
I was just wondering why in the particle accelerators, the people can get the particles to go 99% of the speed of light, but not actually the speed of light.
The reason is when you actually accelerate objects, well, you actually accelerate them to higher and higher speeds, they actually get heavier and heavier, so they actually weigh more. And so if you've got an object moving at 99% of the speed of light, it might be 10, 20 times heavier than what it was. And to accelerate a heavier object, it's harder. You need more oomph, more effort, more force. And so it gets harder, exponentially harder and harder to accelerate them more and more. And so that's actually why they can't get them. They can get up to about 99, and I think there are 5 nines after that. But to actually get to 6 nines and 7 nines, it gets just harder and harder. So.
Much. Let's show Damien our appreciation one more time. Thank you. I might want to point out we do have a lecture about Einstein's family coming up in the week we call Einstein the Man, and I know there's a specific lecture about his relationships and the wife and his wife in particular. Thank you very much for coming. Enjoy the rest of the exhibits and lectures, and we'll hope to